This is the time set for argument on case number 82898, Monk versus Ching. I always like to remind people at the beginning of argument about the process, which some people know better than others, right? So when you come up, you're going to be asked if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, but either way, you get a total of 15 minutes, and even if you reserve time for rebuttal, that just means the yellow light is going to come on when you get to that point, but the clock will still keep running. So if you keep talking, we keep asking you questions, the time keeps running and can run out on you. Of course, you get your 15 minutes on your side, and for you, the yellow light will come on when it gets down to 5 minutes, and of course, the red light when your time has run out. All right? Everybody ready? Why don't you come on up then and tell me if you'd like to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, that's when the yellow light will come on and you'll hear a tone also. Go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Holmes, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant, David Monk. The case before this court today involves the application of the statute, NRS 41A071, and its purpose in deterring and protecting medical providers from frivolous lawsuits while still protecting a plaintiff's right to litigate meritorious claims. In this case, this principle was effectively flipped on its head when a clear-cut case of medical negligence was dismissed with prejudice simply because of the licensure of Monk's expert. In this case, Monk filed his complaint with a...
Counsel, can I ask you a question about that? So, Nurse Hambrick doesn't really address the doctors in her affidavit, does she? I mean, she only talks at all about McNichol, and even that isn't to a reasonable degree of nursing improbability.
So there is... You're correct that two of the doctors are not referenced specifically in there, but I believe under the Zohar case, you know, the complaint has to be read in conjunction with the affidavit, and the complaint is very thorough as to each doctor's negligence and the allegations against each doctor. This court has previously held that must be this statute should be applied very liberally and only should only be used to dismiss frivolous lawsuits. And I believe in Zohar, there was, again, in that case, there was doctors that weren't mentioned by name in the affidavit, but the court said, reading the affidavit in conjunction with the complaint, it's clear what the allegations were. And the doctors were on notice of the negligence that was asserted against them, and the case was allowed to proceed.
Well, even if you read it together with the complaint, don't you have to have, I mean, isn't the point of the affidavit requirement to have the affiant offer an opinion that the defendants fell below the standard of care? Like even as a group, like what in the affidavit purports to reference them and offer an opinion that they fell below the standard of care?
I believe in the conclusion that Nurse Hambrick reached, that she did address all three of the defendants and addressed all of their standards of care. I believe the only issue that was raised by response in the case is that throughout the affidavit itself in the body, there wasn't much reference to these defendants, but
so when it came to... I'm sorry. So are you saying in paragraph 47, when she says the University Medical Center Las Vegas and its nursing and physical therapy staff, that includes the physicians?
I believe it is that. And under paragraph 46, where she says, due to the negligence of Dr. McNichol and...
That's the only reference.
Yes. So I believe under 47 and 48, the doctors will be included in that as they were part of the team that was providing care. And again, I just refer back to the court's decision in Zohar, where the failure of the affidavit itself to mention this wasn't found to be grounds to dismiss the complaint in its entirety.
You're tall. Is it possible to get the mic higher up closer to you?
Yes. Sorry about that.
Yes.
Again, so the the policy that was set forth in Zohar is that this should only really be used to dismiss frivolous cases. And here, respondents are arguing is basically a technical way to get around what is a clear-cut case of negligence. This is not something where, you know, reasonable minds can differ as whether it's reasonable to leave 2 feet of gauze in the patient's throat for 5 months.
Sure. So it should have been easy to get someone to submit an affidavit saying so.
You'd think. Hindsight's always 20/20. And, you know, obviously at the time that this was filed, we felt that it was appropriate. But you know, things come out and arguments get made that you might not foresee. And, yeah. You know, again, I think this is right on par with what the court decided in Zohar.
Let me ask this. That reminds me of another question I had. Did you, or more properly, your clients at any time during this process ask for leave to be able to amend or to submit a more particular or different affidavit?
I don't believe a request for amend was made, but there was a supplemental affidavit that was submitted in with the opposition to the motion to dismiss that did provide a little more clarity as to the specific allegations and things of that nature.
Okay.
And again, I'd like to remind the court that when this came before the district court, there was no discussion over whether it was specific enough or the qualifications of our expert. The only discussion that the district court held was, you know, she's a nurse and she can't opine as to a physician's standard of care.
So what in her affidavit shows that she practices or has practiced in an area substantially similar to what these doctors were doing in their practice that's being questioned in this case?
So it's within her supplemental affidavit, and it's always also within the CV that was attached to the initial complaint, where she has held a certification in wound care since 2005. She's worked in wound care-related fields since 2003. She's floated to various floors throughout her 10 years of nursing.
How often did she actually, that's fine that she floated as needed, but does that mean she was actually involved in this kind of treatment?
She wasn't. She testified that she had extensive experience with wounds of the face and throat and things of that nature.
And this is in the supplemental affidavit?
I believe that was in the supplemental affidavit, yes. And then obviously all of her qualifications were included in her CV, which is attached to the initial.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to have much in the terms of, I mean, she has some experience with burn units in the past, but it looks like she was primarily a cardiac nurse.
I think she had a lot of varying experience, and she was with the Children's Hospital from 2003 to 2007. She was specifically engaging in wound care there, and then when she floated the other hospitals, you know, the med surge and post-operative care floors, there's a lot of wound care that happens there where you're dealing with incision sites, things of that nature. And obviously she would have been able to testify more accurately as to that, but the district court didn't really inquire into her qualifications at all, simply.
I'm looking at one of the sections about being at the Children's Hospital, and it doesn't say a thing about wound care.
I believe it was there. In front of me. I believe it was when she was in Minnesota. This is 2003 to 2007. Let's
see if I have that. That's the St. Louis. 2003 to 2000. Oh, there's overlapping. Okay.
I only see the wound care in relation to working for the burn centers, and I'm just not sure that's the same sort of thing as we're seeing here.
I mean, there's definitely, you know,
to say, because it has to be a practice in a substantially similar area under the affidavit requirement, right?
Correct. And, you know, her practice in wound care is spread throughout different fields. You know, burn care is obviously, there's very specific wound care that goes into burns, and there's other care that goes into, you know, post-operative surgery floors where she's been working. And she has, you know, a general certification in wound care that dated back to 2005. And again, I...
What is it that these doctors did that you're saying was negligence? Because, let me put it this way. The focus as to the doctors seems to be on, like, inadequate documentation in the records of measurements and things and what they were supposed to document, and I guess instructions to the nursing staff. Like, they weren't the ones who actually put the packing in or would have been the ones to take it out.
Correct.
Is that right?
That falls on the nursing staff, and that's why we believe that Nurse Hamrick is qualified to testify, is because she's the one that actually does the hands-on dealing with these types of wounds and things of that nature. The doctors failed to track the wound. They failed to note basically what was occurring, and they failed to ensure that their orders were followed.
How does being the one that actually follows the doctor's instructions to put it in and or take it out, how is that substantially similar to what you're saying the doctors themselves did wrong here?
Well, I think it's similar in the fact that when you're doing that day to day and you see what you're supposed to do, and you know, if I have a wound here, I'm supposed to track the opening. I'm supposed to make sure, you know, if it's not seeping, if it's swelling, that means there's something wrong. I need to observe this. I'm not tracking the depth of the wound. I'm not tracking what's going in and out of the wound. Mm-hmm. Doing that as a nurse, you know, the doctor should be doing the same thing. You don't need a medical degree to know that this is the process I'm going through. This is what we do on a day-to-day basis. This is the standard of care that needs to be provided.
Just to be simple about this, though, the first amended complaint, as I read it, the allegations with respect to the three doctors who are represented here are in the second claim for relief. Pages 13 to 14, is that right?
Correct.
And then in the nurse's affidavit that was submitted with the complaint, the only doctor who's even mentioned is McNichol, correct?
Correct.
So, and the only allegations are 46, 47, and 48 in that affidavit as to breach of the standard of care and her opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And the problem I have is the opinion seems to be directed at nursing and hospital care, not at standard of medical care by a physician. And I'm not disputing the Williams case or that a nurse can offer an opinion, but did she, even reading the complaint in tandem with her affidavit, offer such an opinion here? And if so, where is that opinion, especially as to the two doctors other than McNichols?
I believe the opinion is contained in that same area because it's what she's saying is that they failed to properly supervise and engage in their duties to, you know, instruct and observe and follow these procedures and things of that nature. And again, I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I'll leave the court with.
Okay.
I think that there's, you know, the rest of the locator exception that we didn't get to, but even if this affidavit didn't meet the requirements for the second cause of action, we feel that that falls into the exception under NRS 41A.
Because that is my core question with this. Like, consistent with the statute, we should be protecting the doctor if the technical requirements of the statute aren't satisfied. I mean, that's a. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Bridget Foley. I represent the respondent doctors, in this case, Drs. Ching, Dr. Young, and Dr. McNichol. The two issues in this case really are, one, whether 41A.07.1 applies in this case, which respondents submit it does apply in this case because there is no enumerated exception under 41A.100.1 that would apply, that would obviate the need for a medical expert affidavit. And
the district court didn't reach the res ipsa issue, though. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The second is, because the respondents submit that 41A.07.1 affidavit requirement applies, whether Nurse Hambrick's affidavit meets that requirement, and respondents submit that it does not for many reasons that this court has already addressed and asked appellant's counsel about.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? So we have some cases that talk about leaving something in during surgery, but the statute actually says, the res ipsa statute says following surgery. Do you think that there's a difference?
There isn't a difference, and the Peck v. Zip case really highlights that fact. The statute itself says following surgery, meaning that the object is retained after the patient is wheeled out of the operating room and the operating doors have closed and the patient's now in the PACU. It does not contemplate what happened here where these surgeries occurred and then later down the line there was wound care that was being done where this alleged packing gauze was left in the patient's body. So
is there any argument that the process of opening the wound and packing it was itself surgery? But then I guess it would be intentionally left at that point.
Yes. So again, so two parts to answer your question, Justice Pickering. One is that wound care is not a surgical procedure, just like in the Peck v. Zip case, they determined that inserting an IV is not a surgical procedure. Giving someone a shot, something like that, is not a procedure. There are these procedures that involve cutting open the skin or addressing open wounds in the skin, but those are not surgical procedures. Those are not operative measures that are performed by a surgeon in a surgery center or in a hospital setting.
But didn't they have to open this wound and undo the stitches to do the wound packing?
Yes, they did, Your Honor, but it would still be more akin to inserting an IV or a PICC line or even a post-surgical Penrose drain, which is what a lot of courts have addressed in issues similar to the one here. And specifically, the California Court of Appeals addressed the issue of whether Penrose drains are that are inserted and then later removed after surgery, both inserted and removed after surgery, like the gauze was in this case, whether that falls under California's res ipsa exception to their microaffidavit requirements. And that case is Scott v. Raher, which is 185 Cal App 4th, 1535. And it was decided by the Second District Court of Appeals in June 2010. That court stated that competent medical expert testimony is required to describe the proper use, purpose, insertion, and removal of a Penrose drain. A Penrose drain is inserted after surgery and was intended to be retained temporarily. The retention and removal of the drain involve complex medical procedures beyond the comprehension of a layperson, and therefore that court determined that the expert affidavit is required and that this foreign object unintentionally left in the body during surgery is not the situation that is contemplated where a Penrose drain is partially retained after surgery. And to go back to Justice Bell's question, respondents do submit that the statutory language of 41A100 does mean that under 41A100(1A) of a foreign substance other than medication or prosthetic device was unintentionally left within the body of a patient following surgery. That's intended to mean immediately following surgery, which, again, this court went through that analysis in Peck v. Zip. The court analyzed what surgery means, and they also briefly touched on what unintentionally mean. Here we have neither of those factors. We don't have a foreign body that was unintentionally left in the body. The packing gauze was intentionally left in the body to try to ward off and prevent infection, much like the Penrose drains are often inserted after a surgery to draw liquid away from liquid and fluid away from the surgery site to try to prevent infection.
Could you clarify the three doctors who are the moving defendants here?
Yes.
What was their actual roles? Number one, it appears they weren't involved in the actual surgery. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And are they all residents, or is one of them a supervising doctor over residents? What's their roles?
So all three doctors, Drs. Ching, Young, and McNichol, are residents. Drs. Ching and Young are otolaryngology resident, and then Dr. McNichol is a general surgery resident. And that inquiry touches on the next point we want to make, which is that Nurse Hambrick, while she's a very well-qualified nurse in many aspects, is not qualified to offer medical causation and standard of care opinions against these three doctors in this case. As the court has already touched upon, she doesn't have the wound care experience from the perspective of otolaryngology medical practice or general surgery medical practice, monitoring, decision-making, diagnosis, and treatment.
Well, can you read her affidavit generously to say that she has experience in providing nursing care to people who are post-surgically in the hospital? I mean, it seems like that would be under the ambit of what she's able to do.
Yes, we would concede that she can offer testimony as to nursing care, post-operative nursing wound care in the hospital.
So if she can she offer testimony that her experience as a nurse is that confronted with a wound like this, packed like this, with these conditions, she would have expected to receive written instructions from the doctor with respect to monitoring that wound?
She can, I want to make sure I understand your question, Justice Pickering. So she can offer opinions that of what the nursing staff in a hospital providing wound care treatment to a patient.
Well, her experience is she interacts with doctors in the hospital treating patients and carrying out their orders.
Correct.
And there's allegations in the complaint. The affidavit is problematic, and I've addressed a little bit of that. But
yes,
it seems like she could say, as a nurse, in my experience, when I deal with doctors who pack this kind of wound, they should have the norm would be that they would instruct us to check every 12 hours to make sure infection hasn't set in or the acetic is working and the infection is subsiding, whatever. I mean, it seems like the two work hand in glove. So she could give an expert opinion as to how she would expect doctors to instruct nurses working under their supervision in post-operative patient care.
So respondents would submit that she can offer opinions about what the nursing staff in handling the wound care would be expected to do and look at, and if there were insufficient instructions or orders, that whether the nursing staff would have an obligation to address those issues with the providers who are providing these orders and instructions. But taking that leap over the line and saying she is now qualified to offer opinions on medical standard of care for otolaryngologists and a general surgeon, as well as medical causation opinions, is too far of a leap because that goes beyond her level of competency as a registered nurse.
Are you suggesting a nurse could never give an opinion in? And I think we need to be really clear because I think there's different standards for the affidavit versus an expert testimony at trial, right?
Correct.
In an affidavit attached to a medical malpractice complaint, that a nurse could never be an expert against a physician.
No, we are not making that argument. There are situations where a nurse would be qualified to offer standard of care opinions against doctors if they are performing the same functions. A doctor and a nurse performs the same functions. So sometimes you go to the hospital, you have a nurse try three times to insert an IV, it doesn't work. The anesthesiologist might come in and say, I'm going to do it myself. They insert the IV. That might be a situation where a nurse could come in and testify about inserting an IV because that is something that the nursing staff does, or actually administering medications to a patient that have already been ordered. That's something that a registered nurse would be doing in a hospital setting. But when you get to the situation that we have here where the nurse is trying to offer an opinion as to the evaluation, decision-making process, treatment plan, entering orders, even determining whether to downgrade the patient from ICU to IMC, intermediate care, those are decisions that are made by the higher level providers, by the MDs. And that's where Nurse Hambrick falls short in her affidavit. And really that's highlighted at the end of her affidavit where she says her opinions are to a reasonable degree of nursing probability or certainty and not medical probability or certainty, because she cannot take that leap over that line in this case.
Could you address the sufficiency of the affidavit and complaint? You would agree that our case law says we can read them together in determining, and we have a statute that says you can address a doctor by name or by what the doctor did or didn't do, presumably where you might not know who the doctor is. But one of the threshold questions in this case, apart from the legal issues, is does this complaint read in tandem with the affidavit adequately establish an opinion that these doctors were negligent, especially the two doctors besides Dr. McNichol, but also Dr. McNichols?
So this affidavit, even when read in tandem with the complaint, does not meet the requirements for sufficiently stating the allegations that need to be stated to support a claim for medical malpractice. We still look at NRS 41A071 that has to support the allegations contained in the action by a medical expert who practiced and substantially similar to the type of practice engaged in at the time of the professional negligence, identifies by name or describes by conduct. We don't have either of those things for doctors Ching and Young in the affidavit, certainly. And really, it's very scant as to Dr. McNichol, and sets forth factually a specific act or acts of alleged negligence separately as to each defendant in simple, concise, and direct terms. And
well, the complaint arguably does that, right?
It does it more so than the affidavit does it, but it's still insufficient, especially as to Drs. Ching and Dr. Young, and also as to Dr. McNichol as well. It doesn't sufficiently set forth the specific acts. And Zohar v. Zabijan, case law is, we have to look at it in the real world context and how that applies in the real world. And really that's where that case is really designed to apply, where you don't have all the facts in front of you. You have names that, or you're missing certain names. You have the Roe and Doe defendants. You might not have complete records. There might be issues like that. Here, we don't have that. They had the records. They have the names of everyone. It's just still insufficient at the end of the day.
I'm going to be over time with her, but paragraph 46 of the complaint of the affidavit as to Dr. McNichol, tell me why that is not sufficient as to Dr. McNichol.
Well, first and foremost, the claims against Dr. McNichol, may I finish my
response?
Yes, go ahead. Okay. First and foremost, the claims against Dr. McNichol are not able to be presented by Nurse Hambrick because she does not meet the requirements of NRS 41A071. Secondly, the allegations in paragraph 46 are not stated, they're not to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, and that's really where the analysis has to go to, is that everything is stated to a reasonable degree of nursing probability or certainty in that affidavit, and not medical probability or certainty, and that's where the affidavit also really fails under NRS 41A071. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. As far as the arguments under the res ipsa loquitur exception, I'd like to point this court to some language that was included in Cummings v. Barber, which was decided in 2020. This court held, we decline to adopt an interpretation of NRS 41A100, subsection 1A, that precludes application where negligence can be shown based on common knowledge alone, because such preclusion is clearly inconsistent with the legislature's intent. This is a case.
Sure, but that was a case that involved something actually left in during the surgery.
This is correct, Your Honor. I believe that one was actually, it was a following surgery where something was left. It was a bit of a muddled factual situation.
Yes.
But this court, I don't think, has been presented with a case like this, where there is standard post-surgery care that is necessitated only really in instances of surgery where they have to open someone's throat, put tubes in, put gauze in, things like that. And then it's unintentionally
left. And this happened days after the surgery, correct?
Correct. I believe it was in the week. Yes. And then, you know, they say that this was intentionally left in there. You know, it was intentionally placed in there. It most certainly was not intentionally left in there. If they have a practice of intentionally leaving packing gauze in someone's throat.
How would this be different than some other non-surgical sort of wound that was packed, though, right? Because this scenario could happen without a surgery at all.
That's correct. It could. And, you know, I believe that's why we have to look really to the legislature's intent on this. And the intent was in situations where anybody off the street can say, yeah, that's negligence. This is supposed to be covered by that. And obviously, in hindsight, you know, they can use different words to mean different things. But here, you know, they said following surgery. This was a standard procedure that was following surgery, and it was left there.
Sorry. Is it your position that the entire case as to these defendants would be covered by res ipsa, or is it just part of the allegations? Like, I'm just trying to understand. It wasn't clear to me.
I believe, so in this case, there's two separate causes of medical malpractice. One of them, I believe, is against the facility in UMC, not right. against these defendants. That's right. separate. Right. This specific cause of action, we believe, is wholly covered under the res ipsa locator exception.
So all claims, all allegations against these three doctors, you think would be covered under res ipsa?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, you know, this court asked respondents counsel whether they were saying that a nurse should never be able to testify against a physician. And they said, no, they weren't saying that. They just said they could only testify against a physician if it related to nursing related things. And that's specifically what this court rejected in Williams when it said, we don't look to what the statutory practice, what the practice of nursing is defined as. We look to their actual qualifications, their actual experience.
But Williams is a testimony case, right? And I think that that's something very different than the affidavit, which has a specific requirement of practice in a substantially similar area.
Correct. And I believe, you know, respondents have said that they don't practice in the, I'm going to butcher this word, but otolaryngology or
otolaryngology.
There you go. Much better than I can. But she does have experience in wound care. This is something she does regularly. This is something that most nurses do with regularity. So I'm going to finish. And so we believe that the substantial similar area that is issue here is not general surgery. It's not otolaryngology.
We understand what you're saying.
Exactly. Well, hopefully the transcript will reflect that. it's wound care. It's post-operative surgery care, something that nurses are well qualified in, and that specifically nurse Hamburg is qualified to testify about. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. We appreciate the briefing and the arguments in this case. The case will now stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court.